Good morning and welcome back to the series that we're doing. Six lessons from different times of Jewish history. Nice to see everyone that braved the freezing weather here today. It's really cold. And just before we start, just a reminder in case I forget later. First of all, a big thank you to all those that have already participated in the raffle, which is going really well. We've got 2 weeks to go. We're going to draw it in 2 weeks. This series for another 2 weeks, next week and the week after. And the last in 2 weeks' time, the last Thursday of the term, as we always do, we'll draw the raffle. So those who haven't yet participated, here's your chance. Please see the office afterwards and participate as best you can. Just a quick review from last week. Last week we did, very early on in Jewish history, the Jewish people coming out of Egypt, and we talked about the three leaders of Moshe, Aharon, and Miriam. So as the Talmud tells us, these are the three leaders that, of course, Moses was the main leader and took us out of Egypt, but we talked about the leadership of the three siblings, Moshe, Aharon, and Miriam. We discussed the partnership between Moses and Aaron, that Moses was truth and Aaron was peace, and the combination of both and how that has to work together. On the one hand, Aaron was the person who loved everyone because they were created by God, but they still need education. That's where Moshe Rabbeinu comes in. We talked about the great attribute of Aaron, that he was able to, when Moses came back to Egypt and assumed the main mantle of leadership, God assured him that, which was the case later, that Aaron would see him and be happy in his heart for his brother, even though his brother was younger and had assumed the greater level of leadership, but he'd be happy for him, and that's the lesson that we learn in terms of, you know, there's a beautiful word in Yiddish. I don't know if it doesn't really have an English equivalent, but there's a beautiful word in Yiddish. It's called farginen. Farginen means to, in modern Hebrew, they have a word. It's called lefargen. But it means to, like, be really happy for someone else's success and to be okay with it, but more than okay. It means to actually really celebrate the success of someone else. And that was Aaron. Aaron had that amazing humility and love for others to be able to do that. Interesting. I didn't pick up on this last week, but maybe because it was relevant last week because it's this week's parasha. But interesting, it comes up in this week's parasha, which is interesting. I didn't realize until yesterday. Well, I didn't notice this, I should say. This week's parasha is Korach, which was the rebellion of Korach and his men against Moshe and Aaron, and they disputed the priesthood of Aaron and so on. And at the end of the parasha, the Torah outlines all of the gifts that were given to the Kohanim. You know, the Kohanim didn't have real estate in the land of Israel, but they were given all these different gifts. And the Torah uses the expression when God says to him that, Hine, behold, I'm going to give these gifts to Aaron and the Kohanim and the Levim. And Rashi points out that the word Hine is an expression of joy. God says, I'm not just giving these gifts to the Kohanim, I'm giving it with joy. Why? So some of the commentaries point out because there's a different Hine that we find very early on, which is where the story takes place of Moses coming back to Egypt, where Aaron comes out to meet him and it says, Hine, behold, Aaron will come out and be happy for him. So because Aaron was so happy to see the success of his brother, God rewarded the Kohanim with Hine, with the gifts that were given from God with joy. And I just thought I'd mention that because it's actually in this week's parasha. And then at the end we discussed at great length Miriam. Miriam was the woman of hope, belief, emunah, in a very real and tangible way. She stood up to Pharaoh, wouldn't give up on the Jewish people, admonished her parents when they separated, wouldn't have more children because of the decrees of Pharaoh, saying, no, you have to, because that's the belief that we have, that we will be a nation, the nation will continue, we'll leave Egypt, and so on. Didn't give up on a single child when her brother was put into the reeds in the Yamsuf, in the Nile River, I mean. She waited to see what was going to happen because she believed it would turn out okay. And she was the one who inspired the women to take out the tambourines from Egypt that we talked about last week, which is a very beautiful idea. That when they sang song, it's somehow only the women had tambourines, not the men, because the women were so clear that it was going to be okay, that they'd celebrate and sing, that they actually took instruments out with them to be ready. Whereas the men, their emunah was not so much. But, I mean, it was great, but not as great as the women. Okay. Today, I'm going to do something interesting because I'm actually going to go to the opposite end of history almost and jump to a difficult period in Jewish history not so long ago, after the Shoah, after the Holocaust, where the Jewish nation was shattered on so many different levels, and many great Jewish leaders were busy and put themselves into the rebuilding of the Jewish nation on all levels, spiritually, emotionally, physically, financially, whatever the case might be. And there were many things that happened and many fascinating experiences that took place in order to ensure that the resurgence of the Jewish people and Jewishness would take place after the destruction of Europe in such a big way. And I'm doing it today because actually today I want to do something which is slightly personal for me in a way, but I want to dedicate today's shiur to the Lubavitcher Rebbe of blessed memory, whose yahrzeit, his day of passing, the 27th day of the anniversary of his passing, is this coming Sunday, the 3rd of Tammuz. And we know that the Kabbalists tell us that a yahrzeit of any tzaddik is a very significant day. It's a day where the energy and the lessons from his life or her life comes to life and sort of infuses existence with an energy of positivity and holiness and so on and so forth. But as I said before, for me it's also a bit of a personal day because I had the great merit of spending a number of years in New York learning in the yeshiva next to him, hearing hundreds and hundreds of hours of his talks and so on and so forth. So that's that personal touch to it as well, which I'm going to share with you some personal memories as well throughout the shiur. But it was he that led a very, very big campaign in the early, when he assumed leadership in 1950, to really rebuild in a very big way. And I want to talk about that because we know that, and we've spoken about this many times, we know that the resilience of the Jewish people as a whole is amazing throughout history. Whenever we had a challenge, we bounced back in the most unbelievable and miraculous way. We spoke about this a number of weeks ago when we talked about Rabbi Akiva. Right? And every time we have these amazing people who inspire and lead and sort of take initiative and show the way, so to speak, of how we can do this. The important part, of course, is not just to tell stories, because that's not what it's about. The important part of it is to tell stories in a way where we can inspire ourselves. Because as we know, we're all, as we said many times, we're all leaders in our own way. And we're all leaders, like all leaders, that have ups and downs, and we all need to understand the methodology and the strategies and the inspiration of how we move forward and how we rebuild, whether something minor or something major. It doesn't make a difference, but the lessons are the same. So the context, of course, is that in 1945, as we know, the Jewish world was shattered, right? And among others, as I said, the Rebbe was one who looked forward. He looked forward in an amazing way to rebuild. I'll just quote for you something that Rabbi Sachs wrote. I'm sure many of you are aware, Rabbi Sachs had a very strong and personal connection with the Rebbe. It was the Rebbe who actually pushed Rabbi Sachs, as he writes in many places himself, to engage in a completely different path of life that he was planning to. And as a result, he became eventually the chief rabbi and became Rabbi Sachs, the great Rabbi Sachs, who inspired in his own right so many hundreds of thousands of people. So he wrote an article 2 years ago. This is not long before he passed away, obviously, 2 years ago for the 25th yahrzeit of the Rebbe's passing. And he said, and he wrote about how he identifies with the Rebbe in three ways. And he said, I asked myself for many years, how is it that the Rebbe developed a whole new concept of outreach that never existed over in history over Jewish life? And he says, my hypothesis is, which is no more than a hypothesis, was that the Rebbe was, with deep faith, trying to do what seems almost impossible to do. And he says, the only possible tikkun, which means rectification, of the Shoah. If Hitler had tracked down every Jew in hate, he would search out every Jew in love. That was the only force for good equal to and opposite to the force for evil that was in the Holocaust. Now, how enormously relevant that is today, and he writes this 2 years ago, and I think it's now become more relevant, right? And I think this is why this is so important, right? Now, how enormously relevant that is today as we see anti-Semitism return to the world, to Europe, and to the world at large. Our fundamental response, the Rebbe would be telling us right now, is not just to protest anti-Semitism, which we should do anyways, but to actively engage in Ahavat Yisrael, love of a fellow Jew. Actually, to go out and tell Jews, you are loved, we are your family, we're not going to let you go. I think this is a very powerful message. We should have an Ahavat Yisrael campaign. That's what Rabbi Sacks writes. That is equal and opposite to the force of anti-Semitism sweeping the world at this moment. So that's a good sort of context to understand where we're going with this, because this is to think big and to think about reaching others and to connect to others, particularly in a time where there's so much hate directed towards us. So I said the point of this discussion is to draw inspiration and not just tell stories, which leads me to a story. The Rebbe would have his famous, later on in years, I'll tell you why it was later, but later on in years, he would have this famous dollars that he would give out on Sunday. And there was an opportunity for people to have a quick word with him, to ask for a blessing, whatever the case was. And I myself attended many of these Sunday dollars and so on, and got dollars from the Rebbe and a blessing. And I never spoke that much. I used to just get the blessing and move on, unless I had something. In fact, one of the only times I did speak up at dollars was a few days before my birthday, which is next week. And I said to the Rebbe, that's why I'm remembering it now, that's all. And I very nervously told the Rebbe, this is my birthday, it's my birthday coming up. And he gave me an extra dollar with a blessing for a good year and so on. So, yeah, different memories. But so someone once came to the Rebbe by dollars on Sunday. He was a very big macher, one of these big philanthropists, I don't know exactly, who hadn't seen the Rebbe for many years. And he had previously, in the early years, had a private audience with the Rebbe. And in talking to him, the Rebbe mentioned, there's a video of it, you can see it, the Rebbe mentioned to him something that they'd spoken about, I don't know, 25 years before. And the guy was amazed at the Rebbe's memory, which of course we know the Rebbe had a phenomenal memory. So he said to the Rebbe, Rabbi, you're amazing. To which the Rebbe responded, very typically, because the Rebbe, every dollars, every encounter, we'll talk about this later, always demanded something. He always wanted people to grow, to push themselves. The Rebbe looks at him with a twinkle in his eye, with a nice big smile, and says, and what benefit are you going to have from the fact that I'm amazing? like, not thank you for the compliment, but... and we'll see how he can get away with this. I will talk about it, because it's a very, very important thing, actually. And the guy says, no, of course, I'm going to do more, and I'm going to try. So this is like, I don't... Tachlis. What's Tachlis going to come out of this, right? So this is the idea. We tell these stories, and we talk about these concepts, and we've been doing for the last few weeks from different times of Jewish history and different great people along the way, as we did last week with Miriam and so on. Obviously, the idea is to take it and internalize it and try to implement those lessons in our own life. Okay, so I want to focus on four ideas, because there's lots of things we could talk about, but I'm going to focus on four aspects of his leadership and sort of focus on four concepts. The first is the idea of looking forward and looking broad, having a vision, right? So I'll just give you a little bit of history. So the Rebbe was born in 1902. And actually, until he was over 40, he was very reserved. He was a very quiet person. We don't know very much. I mean, later, different people from his town where he was born in tell stories. But we know actually very little about his youth. We know that he was a son of a great rabbi, who was a relative of the previous Rebbe. He was a very big, studious person. He learned a lot, and so on. But until 1941, where he arrived in America, he was trapped in France, actually, when the war broke out, but miraculously escaped with his wife. And came to America. He even when he got there, he resisted very much. He resisted leadership and he resisted public life. In fact, when he first arrived in America, which was actually just this week, was the anniversary of 80 years ago, in 1941, he actually took up a job in the Navy Yard in Manhattan, the U.S. Navy Yard, because he was also an electrical engineer. He had studied in Sorbonne and Berlin, and he was an engineer, and he actually worked for the government for a few years. But at the same time, in 1941, the previous Rebbe had just arrived a year before in America. It was the middle of the war. And he had established some organizations to lead publishing organizations to publish material in Judaism, outreach organizations, which he put his son-in-law, the Rebbe, at the head. And the Rebbe was really working for the Rebbe then. But obviously, in those years became crucial years when he came to America. And the previous Rebbe, his father-in-law, passed away in 1950. But those were just a few years after the war, and there was work that needed to be done, and it needed to be done in a way where the main emphasis was looking forward. When I say looking forward, you know, I've given you this example before. There was another great Rebbe, a great Hasidic Rebbe, who actually suffered through the Holocaust, the Kloisenberger Rebbe. You've heard me talk about him before. Kozimug Rebbe unfortunately lost a wife and 11 children during the camps. He was in the camp himself. And yet, I mean, he was an unbelievably great man. In the DP camps, already in the DP, he didn't give himself a break. Already in the DP camps, right after the war, the Kloisenberg Rebbe was already gathering children and making a little cheder in the DP camps to educate small children. And then eventually when he got it, and he was already trying to get resources and trying to get Jewish books for the people at the DP camps, there was a very famous story of a Sukkot after they were liberated, where some general, I've forgotten which general it was, came to see what's happening in the DP camps. And Kloisenberg Rebbe came out to meet him, and it was a big show, and this general said to the Rebbe, "What can we do for the Jewish people here?" And he's expecting all kinds of things, and the Kloisenberg Rebbe said to him, "We need lulavim and etrogim for sukkahs." That was his thing, right? So, and then when he came out of, when he eventually emigrated to America and then eventually to Israel, he built two amazing organizations, both in New Jersey and in Israel, in Netanya. He built a hospital, as I've spoken about before, and he did amazing things. Why? Not that, God forbid, he was not cognizant of what happened. He remarried, had children, but he spoke a lot about remembering the Holocaust. And of course, remembering the Holocaust is critical, otherwise we don't learn a lesson, and the world doesn't learn a lesson. But at the same time, the focus was to look forward. We need to remember the past, but we cannot get trapped in the past. And that's a very, very important lesson all the time. Because often people remember, there's a very, very big difference, a nuanced difference between critically remembering what happened and getting stuck in what happened. Two different things completely. Now, it's not easy because people went through horrors and people went through tremendous tragedy, and it's easy to get stuck in the past. But nevertheless, the message and the Rebbe's message always, with everything, was about moving forward. What are we going to do? Learning from the past, but moving forward. And the Rebbe was always very fond of a particular phrase, a phrase that we learn about in the Megillat Esther, the story of Esther, about the Purim story, right? Where when this Purim story was over, the miracle of Purim had taken place, Esther and Mordechai ran this campaign to record the story, right? Which is what we have today, Megillat Esther, which is part of Tanakh. And at the end of Megillat Esther, there's a phrase that says, this is what happened, and this is the date that it happened. V'hayamim ha'elu, and these days, nizkarim v'na'asim, will be remembered and observed. Action. Word na'asim means to do. They will be remembered and they will be done. And he was always incredibly fond of this phrase, because if something is nizkarim, if you get together, if it's a Pesach, if it's a remembering what happened not so long ago, if it's a story we're remembering, there's always got to be, so if there's niskarim, the question is, what's the naasim? What are you going to do about it? How are you going to put it into practice? What lesson are you going to take away from it? So for him, there was no such thing as a niskarim without the naasim. The niskarim is important, zachor is very important, but there's always got to be, okay, so what are we doing about it? What are we doing to rebuild? What are we doing to make sure it never happens again? And what are we doing to rebuild even greater than before? In fact, in another article that Rabbi Sacks wrote, and this he wrote actually, I think, 7 years ago, the 20th anniversary of the passing of the Rebbe, he writes his own story a little bit, and he writes about how he went to do smicha, he went to learn yeshiva on the Rebbe's advice. I don't know if you've seen the story that Rabbi Sacks tells, quite an amazing thing. He, as a philosophy student, he went traveling to America to visit different great people, which he did. He tried to get an audience with the Rebbe, which he couldn't get, so he went to California by Greyhound bus, and he told them to please call him if there's an appointment available. And eventually someone did call him, actually, and he took a bus all the way back. He didn't have money. And he had this amazing audience with the Rebbe, which changed his life. And he says, he writes about it in many places, that he was there to ask the Rebbe questions, which he did. And he said, then suddenly the interview switched, and the Rebbe started asking him questions, which was very typical. And the Rebbe said, so what are you doing for the Jewish people in Cambridge University? And he started saying, well, in the situation I find myself in, and the Rebbe cut him off uncharacteristically, interrupted him, and says, you don't find yourself in a situation, you choose a situation. And he told him he should start doing outreach, and he should start doing it. Eventually he told him he should really, eventually when he consulted the Rebbe, and he said, what career should he choose, being a lawyer, a philosopher, a few different options, going to business, the Rebbe said, neither, and he should go into smicha, and he should train rabbis and become a rabbi himself. And he listened, which is the greatness of Rabbi Sacks, of course. But anyway, so he says, eventually, I'll read this to you. He says, because I want to just bring up one point, he says, I eventually decided to study for smicha. I wanted to demonstrate my gratitude to the person who had led me in this direction. So I devoted much of my spare time that year, which is 5734, which is 1974, to translating some of the Rebbe's talks in English. Eventually, they were published in a book called Torah Studies. That's Rabbi Sachs' first book. It's translations and explanation of the Rebbe's talks. It was a transformative experience in itself. He says, I learned much about the Rebbe from these talks. In particular, look what he says, I began to see how one theme ran like a connecting thread through many of his speeches. The idea of Yerida Letzorech Aliyah, a descent is for the sake of an ascent. In other words, if a challenge happens in a person's life and temporarily they downgrade it, it's all for the purpose to rebuild, but not to rebuild to the point that it was before, but to rebuild stronger. Right? That's a concept in Kabbalah, that every Yerida, everything that comes down is only for the purpose to go up, but to go up even more than before, otherwise there wouldn't be a purpose in the Yerida, right? So everything that happens ultimately is, as you know, is bashkaha pratit, and everything has a purpose, even painful things, that the purpose is to bounce back, but not to the same point. The bounce point much, much stronger and much, much higher than before, right? So that was what he says. He says, assimilation ran high, so did intermarriage rates, but the Rebbe, with his profound belief in divine providence, was convinced that the descent is the beginning of an ascent. Disconnection is a call to reconnection. And tragedy itself is a prelude to redemption. That's how he rescued hope and rekindled the fire that seemed almost to have died. So that concept of looking forward, looking at the painful past as just a step to bounce back even higher. All those kind of things were part of this vision, part of this looking forward. And of course, part of them, which again is something Rabbi Sachs writes about with regard to himself, was that the Rebbe was also fond of a different phrase. He said he's called to action to go and inspire others, right? He used to use a phrase which actually has a very interesting source. It's a phrase that's nothing to do with personal growth or inspiration. It's a phrase found in the Talmud in a very technical halachic sense. It's about fruit which can become impure. And it says it's the only way that a fruit can contract impurity is if it's wet, if it's been made wet by a liquid, right? So he used to say, so the Talmud says there, how wet does it have to be? How wet is called wet? So the Talmud uses a phrase called tofeach al menat lehatfiach. It means it's wet, it has liquid on it, that it has the power to make something else wet, right? See, my hands are wet, but if I touch you, you don't become wet, that's not considered wet. I'm only considered wet if I touch someone else and they also become wet. Understand? It's called tofeach al menat lehatfiach. And the Rebbe used this term to say that when you inspire people, you have to inspire them to such a point that they'll inspire others. In other words, you have to make them wet, and they'll make others wet, right? And he was incredibly focused on this, and which meant that when he encouraged growth, right, part of his campaign, I think it's part of the uniqueness of the Rebbe's sort of vision, is that when he encouraged growth, and this is true for all of us, when we encourage other people, it's not just to encourage them, it's to encourage them in turn to encourage others. And Rabbi Sachs has this very famous, what is now a very famous line, which he made himself. He talks about the first of those was in the, he talks about his own encounters with the Rebbe. He says, was in the summer of 68 when I had my first private audience with the Rebbe, where he challenged me to do something about the loss of Jewish students, Jewish commitments in Cambridge University. I had never even thought of a leadership role, and there was the Rebbe urging me to undertake one. It was reflecting on that encounter many years later that I formulated the proposition, Rabbi Sachs writes, that good leaders create followers, but great leaders create leaders. Right? And that's this concept of tofeach al menat lehatfiach. Again, all part of that vision, moving forward. In other words, moving broadly, inspiring others, but then it should be a ripple effect. It should inspire others further. And that was his vision. I think part of that thinking broadly was one of the things that he did was also that unique, that after the war, he didn't think about his own community, right? I mean, the Chabad community in particular was also very much affected by the war, differently to others, but because they were more mainly Russia, but still very, very affected. And it was very small. In 1950, when the Rebbe took over, I mean, I remember my father telling me, because my father was there from Israel, he came to study by the Rebbe, my father always used to tell me that the first anniversary of the previous Rebbe's yard site in 1951, where the Rebbe officially assumed the mantle of leadership, I asked him to describe me the Fabrengen. And he described where it was, and it was in a room which I'm very familiar with. It's still there in 770. But in my day, there were no Fabrengens in that room, because it's a fairly small room. It's about the size of this room. Right? And that's where the Fabrenum was. It was a very small crowd. I mean, there were people in Israel and England, but it was a very small crowd. But he didn't only think about rebuilding his community, he thought about the world. He didn't think about, one project, it was everything, you know. I was telling someone yesterday, one of the phrases that the Rebbe would use, the language, you know, terminology always counts, right? Always is important. And I remember so much when the Rebbe would talk about campaigns. And the language used to go like this. I'll give you an example. So he would talk about making sure that Jews have matzah for Pesach, right? That was one of his big campaigns, one of many campaigns. But it wasn't like everyone should make sure to give lots of matzah out before Pesach. There was never the language. The language always was, you got to give matzah until there's no Jew in the world that's left without matzah. That was the language, always. In other words, you were never successful until every Jew in the world was taken care of, right? Which reflected later when people would come back and report back on some amazing achievements. It wasn't like what you expected, like, you know, oh, that was absolutely amazing, like, you know, I managed to give out 1,000 people matzahs. They said, okay, next year 2,000. Okay, that was the thing. So it was very, very broad. Which is why the Shlichut campaign, the whole concept of sending people out to other parts of the world, was an incredibly visionary thing, which when it was started in the 50s, it was, I mean, nowadays, like such a common thing, right? I mean, we take it for granted. But in those days, it was mad. I mean, it was considered completely bizarre. In fact, there were many parents of young Marys who were, I can't say upset with the Rebbe because they considered themselves followers of the Rebbe, but they found it very, very difficult. Like, how could the Rebbe take their young marrieds and send them to who knows where, right? I mean, the very first couple that went out, or one of the first couples was Rabbi and Mrs. Gorelick, Rabbi Gorelick, who passed away, to Milano, to Italy. But in those days, going from America to Italy was like going to the moon, right? And that was like, it's crazy, right? I mean, Australia, when that happened, that was like completely off the wall. And it was very difficult. Nowadays, it's just a vision which is so ingrained that just continued. In fact, I was just discussing this with someone yesterday. In 1994, when the Rebbe passed away, people thought it would slow down. The fact is, it actually exploded. There are more shluchim, more people that went out today on shlichut post the Rebbe's passing than before the Rebbe's passing. So it's a campaign which actually continued on, which is amazing. Okay. And in fact, the vision was so broad that in the 90s, I think it was, not 90s, sorry, in the 80s, I mean, the 80s, the late 70s, the 80s, the Rebbe began a campaign not only for Jews. Like, one of his big campaigns in the later years was to inspire non-Jews as well. He had a very big campaign called Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, which is the message and the education that when God gave the Torah, there were seven mitzvot, the famous seven Noachide laws that were supposed to be given to non-Jews as well, that all non-Jews are supposed to keep, got to do with morality and just sort of ensuring that there's a safe and moral civilization of the world. And he took it upon himself to create that campaign as well to educate non-Jews about their mission. So it was very, as I say, the vision was very broad. So it's looking forward and looking broadly. That's sort of the first concept that, and believing that it's possible, I suppose, comes with it, right? That's the first idea. The second, I think, is a very famous idea and a very important idea, which is one of my, I always like to talk about this because I've read many articles and many books. There's a very famous book, for example, from Rabbi Tlushkin, which he wrote for the Rebbe's 20th anniversary of passing, which is a very beautiful book about the Rebbe and the Rebbe's life. But there's something always missing from these books, and I don't know why it is, but this is just the way it is. And that's why I always like to talk about it. And what's missing often, because always the highlight is the Rebbe's love for everyone, his acceptance, his tolerance, his outreach, and so on and so forth. And what's always missed is a combination that came with it, which is his incredible emphasis on education and scholarship. Right? So there was this incredible, and I think it's such an important lesson there, and let me just share it with you. So there was an incredible combination between deep academia and scholarship and action. So to give you an example, as I said before, I was present at many, many of the Rebbe's public gatherings called Fabrenums, right? And what used to happen, just to set the scene so you understand, the Rebbe would come and he would talk for hours, it would go on. So he would say many talks. So he would talk for like 40 minutes or half an hour. Then they would sing a nigun and he would say l'chaim to everyone. And then another talk. And this thing would go on for hours and without notes. It was interesting, they never had notes. And he would talk. And there was this incredible sort of pattern that used to happen every single time. That the first few talks were always very deep and on a very broad range of scholarship topics. It could be Kabbalah, it could be Hasidut, it could be Talmudic law, it could be commentary of Rashi and the Chumash, whatever the case is. Very, very, often very deep and very esoteric and sometimes hard to follow, unless you went afterwards and you reviewed it and so on and so forth. And then he would turn to like the simplest of things about action and about campaigns and about what do you have to do, all in the same sort of context, right? Because he believed that the only way, number one, to connect to God, and the only way to do outreach and to inspire others and to rebuild post-Holocaust first was first and foremost education, as we spoke about last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago, right? And that's why, I mean, today there's hundreds and hundreds of books published in the Rebbe's talks, which are with incredible depth and incredible vast knowledge, right? The publishing, he led a publishing campaign where they would publish manuscripts from previous generations. He would encourage people, if people came to visit him who were rabbis or scholars or knew something, he would say, "Nu, why don't you publish what you're teaching?" And you know, often people would say, "Well, I don't know if I'm worthy for it. You know, maybe you should leave that for bigger scholars." They would say, "No, you gotta publish." Right? I remember once I was watching a video of someone coming to one of these Sunday dollars, and he brought the Rebbe. Sometimes people publish a sefer, a new book, they bring it to the Rebbe sort of as a present. And the Rebbe gave the person a dollar, and this person said, "I'm busy publishing, I think it was my father's, my grandfather's commentaries on Chumash, and I'm happy to present to the Rebbe the first volume of Bereshit, the Genesis, on Genesis," right? The Rebbe says, "Very nice," he gives him an extra dollar, and then suddenly the Rebbe's counting out four more dollars, and he gives it to the person, he says, "This is for the next four books, which I hope, hopefully you won't procrastinate, you'll do it quickly." So the concept was that education is the fabric, and I'm sure that he learned this from, as we talked about 2 weeks ago, that we know that what's kept Jewishness alive throughout the ages, and this is 100% proven, is education, right? As I said 2 weeks ago, that when the Romans destroyed the temple, they thought they'd finished with the Jewish people, and they hadn't because scholarship was still alive until they tried to attack scholarship and banned smicha, banned Jewish learning, and banned Torah, which Rabbi Akiva had to give up his life to overcome, right? But at the same time, there was this incredible combination of scholarship and action, and the Rebbe says that you cannot get lost in scholarship. He was not in favor of people just spending their entire life in even Jewish academia or Jewish scholarship. Once you were enriched with scholarship, once you're enriched with learning, he says, now it's time to go out. Now it's time to put it into practice. Maintain your learning, keep studying for yourself. And that was where the shlichut concept was based on. That there was this idea of people continuing to learn for a year or two after they got married, but then it was off you go, because there has to be action. And he demanded that from everyone. So there was this, I think, one of the two most often used phrases in his talks, which symbolize and sort of represent this combination, was he would always talk about hosafa b'limuda Torah, that we always have to add in our learning of Torah, always. Almost every gathering he would talk about adding in learning. And the other phrase was hamaseh hu haikar, action is the most important thing, they both come from the Talmud. So these two things. In other words, one without the other just doesn't work, because we have to know when we inspire others, when we spring into action, when we lead, when we reach out to other people, we need to know what are we giving them? What are we inspiring them with? We have to have what to inspire them with, right? So inspiring oneself only and learning for oneself, that's not good enough. That's selfish. Inspiring others, but without the content, is ineffective. So there has to always be that combination of growth within scholarship and growth within action. So that's the second point. The third, which I think is so true in every form of leadership, and I think this is often a mistake we all make and people make and so on, is, again, an interesting combination which was amazing to actually see. It was the focus on the big picture on one hand, but the detail and the individual on the other hand, right? And that's a difficult combination, because often people, by definition, naturally do one or the other. Some people are very big picture people, but not detailed people. And some people are very global people, but not individual focused people. And yet some people get very bogged down with details and individuals, but cannot think big picture, right? And one of the things that we witnessed with the Rebbe's life and his leadership and in his whole process of rebuilding was this incredible combination between the two. On the one hand, there was a very big picture focus. I mean, We're talking about a world leader, we're talking about people, someone who was involved in very big picture stuff. The Rebbe, in a very hidden way, until the Iron Curtain came down, was very involved in Russian affairs. A lot of stories only came out later, amazing stuff, of how involved, in fact, he was in a very hidden way. Israel, so many diplomats, so many politicians came to the Rebbe. Yehuda Avner writes about it in his book, of came to seek his counsel and his advice, and he was very, very familiar with, down to the last detail of what's happening in Israel, and very passionate about Israel, and spoke about Israel so many times, and so on. Shlichut campaign, very, very big picture stuff, right? But at the same time, in the most surprising way often, the Rebbe would very much focus on detail and the individual. Never forgot about the importance of an individual. Because the bigger picture is only made up of detail. The bigger community is only made up of individuals. Therefore, if you don't build the individual or you don't build the detail, you don't have a bigger picture. So a bigger picture is so important, but you can't build a bigger picture unless you have specific details, right? And just to give you a little bit of a sort of a kind of an example, a little bit, right? My father used to tell me, and this was in the early years where the Rebbe had more time, so to speak, so he would often sort of focus on the individual needs of the yeshiva students. My father told me he once went into the Rebbe and for they used to go in every year for their birthday in those years for a private audience, and the Rebbe said to him, I like normally it was about giving a blessing for your birthday and also what you're learning, and the Rebbe stopped him and he said, I think you look pale. So you should, the Rebbe said to him, I think you should go to camp this summer. Now, anyone ever met my father would know that my father in camp, like, was not a shidduch altogether. So I once asked my father, how do I know the story? So I once asked my father, do you ever go to camp? He says, once in his life. He said, he went to the Torah Masorah camp in New York. I said, why did you go to camp? He said, he had no choice. The Rebbe told him he had to go to camp. So, those kind of things. Once he had a very, very big issue on a Shabbos. An attack in his stomach. It was a whole story where they thought maybe an appendix, and it wasn't anyway. And that week, the Rebbe happened to see him in the hallway, and they called him over and says, so what was the story? What did the doctor say? What did he tell you to do? And he said it was a special diet they had to keep for a while, something they had to make sure. All these kind of things, right? I mean, I myself, I never realized it at the time, but in 1977, and this was an amazing thing, right? In 1977, when I became Bar Mitzvah, so you can work it out yourself, my grandfather, Rabbi Eloy, who I often talk about, my Zayda, took me on a trip to see the Rebbe, right? In those years, he took me on a whole trip to New York, see the Rebbe, then Europe, and then Israel, was finished with Israel, week in Israel, which was the most amazing, probably one of the most amazing months in my life. Anyway, so when we were there, in those days, the Rebbe was still having what we call yechidut, still private audiences, which used to happen like two or three times a night, and then we go through the night. That's how the Rebbe used to do. He used to do it at night, and it used to start like, I don't know, 9 o'clock at night or something, and go till 6 o'clock in the morning. You kind of got a general time that was your time, but normally you had to wait, because it was, you know, very... And I had my own personal yichidut. I was a 13-year-old boy, which probably in some circumstances, when someone comes to their grandfather, they would have did it together with their grandfather. I didn't, because my grandfather was going to discuss with the Rebbe some confidential stuff about South African community and his rabbinic stuff, so I didn't go with my grandfather. In fact, when my grandfather came in before me, the first question that the Rebbe asked him was, where's your grandson? So he says, he's coming in afterwards himself, okay. And then I went into the Rebbe myself, and the Rebbe, the way it used to be, you didn't speak. You used to write down what you wanted to ask the Rebbe. I just wanted to ask the Rebbe a bracha from Abba Mitzvah. And the Rebbe would look at it and then speak to you, right? And ask you questions. You only spoke if you were spoken to, so to speak. That's how it used to work. And the Rebbe looked out to me and says, which tractate in Talmud are you learning? And I told the Rebbe, and the Rebbe asked me if we learn in English or in Yiddish, which is an interesting question because I actually understood Yiddish, but in school we used to learn in English, and then the whole audience was in English. The Rebbe tested me. Thank God I knew the answers. He asked me a few questions. He asked me if I'm also learning Chassidut as well as Talmud, which I hadn't been at the time. He told me I should start. And he gave me a beautiful blessing afterwards. So the whole thing was about 4 minutes, right? And then he gave me some dollars, and he said, when I come back to South Africa, I should give it for tzedakah and so on. And it didn't hit me till later. Obviously, I wasn't the only one, right? I wasn't the only boy going in that night to Yechidus, right? Or girl. And it hit me later how this most incredible thing that there's a system of Yechidut, where the Rebbe takes private audiences, but it's not reserved for important people. I didn't realize at the time. I just thought it was normal. But Here you have a world leader who used to get thousands, literally thousands of letters in the mail a day, being busy with world stuff, and it's fine for him to focus for 4 minutes on a 13-year-old child, which I didn't realize at the time how amazing that was. But that's kind of what it was. And if there was that focus, one of the things we always saw about him was that if it was even a half a minute focus, like we talk about mindfulness, right? That focus, for that minute, it was like nothing else existed. And later, it became just too much. It became impossible. Especially in 1977, that about a heart attack, and then stopped the private orders, brought it back for a while, but then stopped it completely. But, and people thought, that's it. We used to have this amazing opportunity, but not anymore. And then suddenly, the Rebbe reintroduced a whole new system, the system of dollars on Sunday, right? Which was also, I mean, it was based on the principle that the Rebbe says, that when two people meet, a third person has to have a benefit. So he was very into this idea of giving people money to give tzedakah. So that was the, you know, I connect with you, and then through us, a third person is helped, the whole idea. But also became a opportunity for individuals, again, to have an individual interaction with him, right? So an incredible thing. In other words, and it went much faster. I mean, he used to go every Sunday for like 6-7 hours, but it was, and thousands of people used to go by, but it was very quick. So there was a way to organize it so it wouldn't have to be through these nights and be able to accommodate the crowd. And not everyone went every Sunday, but it was, used to go for a special occasion. You got a quick bracha, and if you had a quick question, there was secretaries around that would make sure things were flowing. So you had to be very quick and say something very quick, and then it would go, right? So that just that focus on the individual was just so important. And I think that's a lesson we can all take, because sometimes we get lost in big things and we forget about how's the individual doing, how's the person doing, right? I'll tell you just a personal story. I don't know if I've told this before, but it's an amazing story about my wife, Dina. So when we moved here already, and we had two children here already, and we had just gone to New York for the Chagim, the Tishrei, you know, Rosh Hashanah and Kippur and so on. And then a few months later, Dina's brother got engaged. In those days, I'm talking about in 1990 something, I think 91 it was or something like that. So we were still just new here, and travel wasn't like as quick as, well, it's not any more quick either, but it became quick for a while, right? And we sort of thought, should she go? Anyway, she did go, and there were reasons for not to go, reasons for going. In fact, I wrote a letter to the Rebbe about it, actually, because there were good reasons either way not to go, and the Rebbe said she should go to her brother's wedding. So she went with it. I stayed here. I was a principal at the school at the time, and Guruji couldn't take off, and she went. But the wedding was in Israel, but she went to New York first. She went to New York. She was pregnant with our third child, with Levi, at the time. And she went by the Rebbe for dollars. So she comes by the Rebbe. I've seen the video. And she went by to the Rebbe, and she said to... "She, you know, you've got to be very focused if you want to ask something." So first of all, she asked the Rebbe a blessing for the pregnancy and for the birth for Levi, and the Rebbe gave her an extra dollar and a blessing, beautiful blessing. And someone, one of the people helping, they said, "Tell the Rebbe you're going to Israel this week." No, sorry, not tell the Rebbe you're going to Israel. So then she said, she was carrying Moshe, my oldest son, and it was like 2 weeks before his birthday. So the Rebbe said, "It's his birthday on the 6th of Nisan." And the Rebbe gave a special extra dollar. And then the Rebbe turned to her and said, "And you don't have a birthday?" Which is a very strange thing to ask someone, don't you think? Like, everyone has a birthday by definition, right? And she became a bit bamboozled, and then someone said to tell the Rebbe you're going to Israel. And she said, and the Rebbe gave her a bracha for the safe travels, and that was it. The Rebbe smiled, and that was it. So I'm sitting in my office Monday morning, and I get this call from Dina, and she says, "I don't know, it's a really strange thing." I went by the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said to me, I asked a bracha for the birthday of Moshele, and the Rebbe said to me, "You don't have a birthday?" Which is a... I said, "I don't know. I believe that everything the Rebbe says has meaning, but I had the faith, the Rebbe was a big tzaddik and so on." And I put down the phone and I thought for a few minutes, and suddenly it hit me. Exactly what happened. Dina's birthday was actually a couple of weeks before, right? And when I came to Australia, I started a practice that goes like this. At every birthday, those days were already faxes. Remember faxes? They were very new in those days. So every birthday, I used to send mine, Dina's, Moshele's, or Mushkele's. I had four members at that time. I would send this. I've been here like for 2 years already, and I'd send a fax. Just a fax. It's our birthday, my birthday, my wife's birthday, my daughter's birthday, my son's birthday. And just a fax, can I ask the Rebbe for a bracha for the birthday? That was it. That was my way of staying connected, I guess. Mm. And I would never get an answer. But Hasidim always had the tradition that you don't have to get an answer for the Rebbe. There was a tradition, old age tradition by Hasidim, that if you write to the Rebbe a note, the Rebbe doesn't have to answer you. He'll take care of it. Don't worry. It's fine. If you're asking for a blessing, he gives the blessing. However he gives it, however he does it, it's fine. That birthday that Dina had 2 weeks before she went to New York, I forgot to write. I forgot to write for her birthday. So that's an incredible story. So when she said for my son's birthday, the Rebbe said to her, and you don't have a birthday? As if to say, like, what happened to you this year? Right? And I never get an answer. I never got answers. It was just that registered. Right? Now, I need to tell you this facts that I wrote is one of literally thousands used to come every day. It wasn't like it was a rare thing. It was most incredible. So I think many more stories to tell, but I want to move on. But the focus on the individual was something very, very important. Later on, quantity-wise, it became harder, but the attitude was still there. Because you cannot build a bigger picture without detail. You cannot build communities without people. And finally, I just want to drill on this a little bit. I see we're running out of time. But finally, it's a very, very important concept. And that is the method of outreach, the method of inspiring other people. And here again, an incredible combination, which I think needs to be understood. Everyone always talks about how accepting the Rebbe was and how non-judgmental the Rebbe was. And that's true. I mean, every person, if you just would watch a video of one of these Sunday dollars, you'll see every type of Jew show up. From the most Haredi Hasidic Jew with long payas to a completely secular, disassociated, unaffiliated person with, I don't know, jeans and who knows what, dressed who knows what, right? I'm not talking about how people dress represents who they are, but I'm just saying it's just, you can see that just is very different. And politicians and simple people, children, old people, every type of person, right? And to the Rebbe, they were all equal, gave them the same attention, loved each person the way they are, accepted the way they are. So often the message that always is told about is his non-judgmentalism, his acceptingness, his, you know, if he saw the soul of a person, he's a Jew, and so on and so forth. But what often gets missed in this idea is actually that he's the most demanding person also. As much as he accepted you the way you are, never judged you, he was always demanding, completely demanding. I do not think there was ever an encounter that the Rebbe had with someone where he didn't ask him or her to do something. Like the story of Rabbi Sacks, right? Always. Every conversation anyone had with the Rebbe came up with a job to do. Always. And it was always do more. And it's always not enough. Right? Sorry?
Don't complain.
It's not enough, right? I mean, a real funny story was, and I've seen the video, so I'm just sharing with you. It's like one of the big sort of machers in, you know, in America they have these things called federations. I don't know if it's like a JCA. It's not quite the same. Anyways, so it came to the Rebbe once and said to the Rebbe, like a very sort of, very, very pleased with himself. And he said to the Rebbe, we've designated $500,000, for the school system or something, for the Chabad school system, I don't know, something like that. So the Rebbe smiles at him and says, did you expect me to be okay with $500,000? So the Rebbe says, no, of course not. In fact, if you were satisfied with $500,000, I'd be worried. In which case, the Rebbe said, you have nothing to worry about. Like next time, like, incredible, right? In fact, one time someone came to the Rebbe and said, had a dilemma like this. I think I've told you the story. And he said to the Rebbe, I want to give $500,000 to tzedakah, but I'm not sure how to do it. Should I publicize it or should I give it quietly? On the one hand, I know the Rebbe always talks about publicizing that people should be inspired. On the other hand, you know, it's really good to give tzedakah in private. So I'm conflicted. The Rebbe said, not a problem. Give $500,000 tzedakah in public, give $500,000 tzedakah in private. So I'm just saying, but on all levels, right? Whether it was another mitzvah, whether it was, you know, I did a mitzvah, so now I do two mitzvahs. Everything was always pushing people, always, right? And it came together, and no one would ever come away thinking the Rebbe judged them or was demanding of them, right? And I was going to share with you a whole in-depth study of this from the Rebbe's view and how he viewed different people in history. But essentially, it boils down to the following point. The reason that he was so demanding, and I think this is such an important lesson, is because when demanding comes as a result of being judgmental, that's a negative demanding. It's like, you're not good the way you are now, or I'm blaming you for not being the way you are now. You should have been better, and therefore I'm telling you to do better. That's, people don't grow from that. That's not inspiring, and that's negative. And that's not true. Why is it not true? Because the reason he was so demanding was specifically because, not in spite of him not being judgmental, it's because he wasn't judgmental. Because, and he spoke about this many, many times. He spoke about it with regard to Avraham Avinu and Moshe Rabbeinu, that when they saw people, particularly Moshe Rabbeinu, there's a whole talk he gave once about Moshe Rabbeinu, that when Moshe Rabbeinu told God, if you don't forgive the Jewish people for the golden calf, count me out of your book. Why? Moshe Rabbeinu, the teacher of Torah, the one who gave us all the instructions not to serve idols. Because Moshe Rabbeinu saw another person, he saw another Jew, he saw holiness. Doesn't matter what the person was. He saw another person, he saw his intrinsic or her intrinsic value. He saw the holiness, the purity, the spark. In other words, it's more than just seeing the potential. This is where the uniqueness comes in. One greatness is, you don't judge someone, you see the person, but you see the potential they could achieve. This was more than seeing the potential. This was seeing them, okay, now. You're a holy being the way you are now. Moshe Rabbeinu tells God, if you don't forgive the Jewish people for the golden calf, I'm out, I'm resigning. Why? Because they're worthy of forgiveness. Why are they worthy of forgiveness? Even if they haven't even repented yet. Because they've got a soul. Every human being is worthy of forgiveness. Every human being has a spark. Every human being has an neshama. And it was clear when anyone had an encounter with the Rebbe, for example, and this is how he rebuilt. He rebuilt a generation of broken people. But he didn't see the brokenness of the person. He saw the wholeness of the person. And the person felt that. When a person had a challenge, he didn't see the person with a challenge. He saw the person without the challenge. And the person felt that. And because, like Moshe Rabbeinu, taking the cue as he spoke about it himself, from Moshe Rabbeinu, because he saw the person as a whole person, as a beautiful person, as a holy person, as a person with a soul, that's why he could demand for them to do even more. Because he saw a person with incredible strength. So of course, we have to nurture that strength. And we have to bring out that strength. And we have to reveal that strength. And we have to reveal that connection that strength of our soul has with God. And that's through engagement, and that's through doing another mitzvah, and that's through, but it wasn't, and therefore the Rebbe spoke once about an amazing thing. He says, when you do outreach and you inspire another person, just connecting with the other person is success already, even if the person, because often, you know, we think, right? I mean, I could tell you this, so we all go through this, right? What happens if you drive a person crazy to come to a shiur and they don't come? So is that success or is that failure? Well, in my mortal brain, that would be a bit of a failure, right? In the Rebbe's view, it wasn't. You spoke to that person, you engaged with that person, that's a success. That's it. That's already a success. Because you engage with another person. And that's connection. If he or she comes to share, that's a bonus. Right? And that's amazing. Which is, by the way, the whole foundation of the Rebbe's mitzvah campaign. You know, they had this mitzvah campaign, right? Of, you know, putting up mezuzahs on people's doors. There was 10-point mitzvah campaign. Putting on tefillin on people. And one of the unique facts behind it was, and people questioned this. People questioned, you go out on the street, and you mention, and you meet someone, right? A Jew who's totally unaffiliated, for example, right? So you meet a man, you say, oh, you're Jewish, let's put on tefillin. And you never see the person again, and chances are the person will never put on tefillin again. So, big deal. So you wasted now half an hour doing what? Person put on tefillin once is the same person, he's still unaffiliated, he hasn't done anything. Or you get a person put on one mezuzah, or whatever the case is, or one mitzvah, or come to one shir, or do a favor for another person, or just one Shabbat, whatever the case was, right? So people question, what's the value of investing time in that? Where's the success in that? So besides that, it's actually factually not true, because many successes have come from that. You plant a seed, and sometimes people become, we have a principle in Birkei Avot, one mitzvah leads to another mitzvah, one engagement leads to another engagement. But it wasn't that. He said, what do you mean? One time mitzvah? One time that you engaged with his holiness, with his soul? One time he's openly connecting to God? What's better than that? It doesn't matter what happens after, because he's intrinsically good anyways. So that combination, so yes, he was one of the most accepting, tolerant people, but also one of the most demanding people, and it was the same thing. It came from exactly the same point. Because you are so pure, the way you are now, not potentially pure. You are so pure the way you are now, And the Rebbe once said to someone, your Jewishness is as strong as my Jewishness, talking about himself. And that person wasn't quite at the level. But, right, because I see that, that's why I can put so much on you. You did so many things, but you can do he saw it in himself, he demanded of himself, very demanding of himself, but he demanded of someone else, because he didn't see other people as being that different to him. And that's that combination. So I think just as it's late, sorry. Just to finish off, the concept, we all have this idea. Again, it's not just stories. We all have this concept that sometimes we have a challenge, or sometimes we have a challenge in our relationship, or sometimes we have a challenge with other people. And we all have to rebuild. It could be a very small thing, not a world to rebuild, but a small thing. But it's always these concepts. We need to think big, we need to think broad. We need to inspire the people to inspire yet other people. We need to know that education is such an important part of rebuilding on all levels. Individuals are so important. The engagement with one individual. Just never get lost in the big picture. And also, both for ourselves and perhaps even with other people. We can be demanding, but never judgmental. We can be demanding because we see the greatness of the other, and therefore we can try and inspire the other to reveal that greatness and to nurture that greatness. So those are just some thoughts. And I said I wanted to share this with you today because these are lessons from this period of time, and I thought today would be appropriate for me to dedicate the shiur to him. Have a wonderful day. We have another 2 weeks, don't forget. And in 2 weeks' time, we'll draw the raffle, as we said in the beginning. Have a great day.